Okay, with the House Education Committee will come to order and let the record reflect that it is 8:04 a.m. Wednesday, February 9, 2011. Will the House Secretary call the roll?
Representative Wilson.
Here.
Representative Seaton.
Here.
Representative Tybee.
Here.
Representative Pruitt. Representative Sisna. Representative Kalasaki.
Here.
Chair Dick.
Here. Okay, at this time I'd like to remind everybody, including myself, to turn off cell phones. Thank you. Okay, we're going to start the this meeting out with a presentation by Superintendent Karen Lettergaard from Iditarod School District. This is by my request because that's where my I started my educational career. So, Karen, are you online?
Yes, I am, Alan. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Karen. Let's see. Sheila has us on Google Earth here, so everybody's looking at McGrath through Google Earth. And if you just want to go ahead with your PowerPoint presentation, Karen.
Okay. And I have with me Isabel Harrington, who's been a business manager with our school district since 1978. Alright. So, let's see. So you have the slides right in front of you. The PowerPoint is up in front of you where it says Iditarod Area School District.
We have that, Karen.
Okay. So, we'll go to the next slide then, number two. And, like so many regions in Alaska, we're large in land area, but our district represents a small, isolated community. We're about the size of the state of Ohio. I don't think you need me to read everything on these slides. Our villages are sprinkled along two river systems, separated actually by the Kuskokwim Mountains, not the Beaver Mountains, but Beaver Mountains is a small area within the Kuskokwim Mountains. Go on to the next slide. So our district currently has seven schools. We represent 10 villages. Three of our schools have closed down due to low enrollment. We also have one distance learning program. And on the right-hand side of this slide, that's McGrath, where our central office is. And on the left, you can see in the back for Kuskokwim, top of the Kuskokwim School, Nikolai. Okay, next slide. Our communities are primarily Athabaskan villages. People are highly dependent upon subsistence, hunting, and fishing. We have five indigenous languages spoken in our villages. We're all Title I schools. You can see the demographics that I've listed here. We do have a low enrollment. Our enrollment has been declining, I would say, for the last 15 years. I think much of this is due to the high cost of living in the villages, but also many people have found work on the slope, and they've moved their families to the cities. They do actually move back and forth between the village and the cities. But. Okay. Grayling is a good example of this decline. This is a picture of David Lewis Memorial School on the top, capacity 120. Current enrollment, 45 students. We do not have scheduled air services between the Kuskokwim side of the district and the Yukon villages. It does cost about $1,200 for a charter. That's the only way to get to the villages from one side of the district to the other is a charter. So tomorrow, when we need to go pick up the Terra Nova test, we're going to spend $1,200 to go to one village to pick up the test for the fourth and eighth graders because they cannot be mailed. Okay, next slide.
Excuse me, Karen, we have a question. Representative Wilson.
I was just wondering, it's going to cost you $1,200 to go to that school. How many kids are at that school?
No, no, we're talking about Shagler. About 14 students right now, but because they have fourth and eighth graders taking the Terra Nova test, which is a state-mandated test, we're not allowed to mail the test. We have to pick it up by a charter and bring it back to McGrath and then repackage it with the other test and mail it in. We do that for the HSGQE and also the all of the SBAs.
Now, will the plane stay there for a day? I'm sure it won't. So, really, you have to make one trip to take the test and another trip to go pick it up?
That's correct.
So, it's costing $2,400, and then for two grades, is that 14 students in those two grades?
No, it's 14 students in the whole school.
So, how many?
There are three students taking those tests there.
So, for three.
We actually sent a charter last week to pick up all the tests, and we joined that with our SPED director. You know, we always try to join to work efficiently. So, we had our SPED director on that charter, and the maintenance person was scheduled, but then he was sick that day. And because when the SPED director was returning with tests from the other sites, the one site did not complete the testing because students were out sick. And that is not acceptable. We have to have all of the students tested, so which is requiring, you know, we do have makeup days. And however, it is snowing here pretty heavily. We don't know if we'll get that charter over there to pick up the test, in which case we'll... But anyhow, that's just the reality of living out here.
Sure.
Okay, and also for the record, let it reflect that Representative Pruitt is here. Representative Kawasaki, did you have a question?
Just a brief question. Thanks, Karen. When the school was first built in Grayling for the capacity of 120 students, how many students actually attended that school? If you know
that. There were 75 or 80 at that time.
Okay.
And, you know, they had built HUD houses, and the population was increasing. So I think the capacity, they were thinking, well, it might get up to 120. So that is the site building that they constructed.
Okay, and let the record...
That they have ever operated at capacity. I'm sure they have not.
And let the record reflect that Representative Sisson is here. And Representative Feige, do you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Getting back to the tests and the $1,200 charter, whose rule is it that you cannot mail those? It would seem to me that certified mail or some other...
State Department of Education.
Okay, so that's a state Department of Education regulation?
Right.
Okay. Karen, you'd be pleased to know the Commissioner of Education is sitting here nodding his head, taking notes. Go ahead with your presentation, Karen.
That's good. That would be a great change if we could just put those in the mail. It's for test security purposes, I'm sure. And... it does pose some financial difficulties.
Go ahead with your presentation, Karen.
Okay. Yeah, our business manager is here. Her calculator is always running, and she says it costs about $10,000 a year to move the test around. Okay. Number six. Talking about shared goals here, student proficiency is number one. Early intervention. You can read what I have here. We try to keep our programs relevant and culturally relevant, relevant to the workplace, and collaboration at all levels of the district. Professional development, I'll go into those a little bit later on here. Next slide. Advanced technology has really helped us to work more efficiently, to increase services to students and staff. And I'll go into detail here on the next slide. One of my goals has really been to build a professional learning community throughout the district. This is my first year as superintendent. I think one of the ultimate ways for teachers to improve and for other staff to improve is through peer mentoring and collaboration. It really does accelerate professional growth. And we built time into our work week for weekly video conference and eLive curriculum meetings. So they happen every week for an hour. The eLive meetings are pretty cool because, well, whereas with video conference, all of the teaching instructional staff can be on at one time, it's difficult to break into smaller groups. So through eLive, people can be moved into rooms in real time and have you know, committee meetings. And then they can move between rooms, and they can be talking to each other, posting notes, completing tasks. And we do that every single Monday morning at 8 o'clock. We have one of those meetings. And then we come back together through video conference to share what the committees have come up with. It also helps to reduce professional isolation. And, you know, our sites are very isolated. Teachers are isolated from each other. So they may be, as I said in my notes here, you may be the only primary teacher in your school, but there are six others in the district to network with. And so these meetings have really, I think, gone a long way to connect the district and to also improve instructional practice by teachers collaborating on how they teach different units, which science kits are working the best, what materials need to be added, assessments, and things like that. And it also provides ongoing professional development without the high cost of travel, time away from home. So that's one way we use advanced technology. And next slide, please. We've also done a lot to connect students through technology. We have, I just have some examples here, but we have a district-wide student government, and they meet every 2 weeks by video conference. So we have district-wide officers, and they become very active. They present resolutions to the school board all the time with things they want changed, and we really like to see them empowered because they're going to be the future leaders of these villages. We, this year, you know, if you only have, like, one high school student in one site and three in another site, how do you offer speech class? And speech is one of our requirements for graduation. This year, we did speech by video conference, and we had 26 students participating in that class. So the students got up to give their speeches. They gave them before 25 other people. And they, the way our video conference is set up is you can see the rooms, you can see who's in each of the rooms around the district. And so we're doing things like that to connect students and give them more real life experiences. We have a science fair every year that the students present to parents and their peers throughout the district by video conference. We do speech therapy through Skype. We have kids attending Sylvan Online one-on-one tutoring where they are hooked up to a computer. The tutor is on the other end talking to them. They're working math problems on whiteboards. It's very interactive. So we're really using advanced technology to bring as many services as we can to our students. And next slide. Everything can't happen through computers. And let's see, about 5 years ago, Isabel Harrington received an A&E grant, which was quite a sizable grant, and the whole focus of that was a lot of intervention in reading and math, but also some trips that brought kids together throughout the district. So we had, you know, enrichment programs, voc ed, bringing kids together for a week of vocational education, summer science camp, summer fine arts camp, things like that. And there are a couple of, the grant has ended, and there are a couple of things that the students just won't let us let go of, and actually we haven't let go of a lot of it, but they raise tons of money. The kids are really good fundraisers, and food will always raise money. Right now, they're preparing for their prom, which is going to happen in Grayling next week. And 7th to 12th graders will go over there. But we do keep, we try to connect our students as much as possible. They've become, through all of these events, they've become very good friends. Okay, next slide.
Excuse me, Karen. Representative Pruitt, you're... Karen, one second.
We have a lot of challenges, but like my motto is no excuses. We really just want to get the job done. But we are losing a lot of high school students as they migrate to boarding programs. And I have mixed feelings about the boarding programs. I love the idea that kids have that choice. but then it's really hard to operate a high school with only 23 students. So, but we're committed to serving the students who are here, regardless of their reason for being here. You can read the different items here. One real challenge is what the secondary teachers face, having to be highly qualified. Of course, we want the teachers to be highly qualified and knowledgeable for every subject that they're teaching. But imagine if you're the only secondary teacher in a school, so you only have 8 7th through 12th grade students, and you're teaching world history and biology and algebra 2, you know, English composition. You have to be highly qualified in every single one of those areas, or or we get nailed. So teachers are constantly having to prepare for the practice 2 exams, which is a good thing. We support that. But it does stretch teachers, and it makes it difficult for them to remain, to keep that highly qualified status. And of course, once we get someone who's highly qualified in all the different areas, often they'll move on to another district or move to the city or someplace else. So then we start all over again the following year. But that's just one of the challenges. I guess our greatest challenge is to creatively adjust our high school program to meet the needs of all of our students. And we, as I mentioned earlier, we're trying to do that through technology-driven courses, eLive, Skype, Illuminate, Moodle. You know, we try it all. And our students are pretty savvy in their use of technology. Partnerships really help. We have partnerships in all of our villages. Here in McGrath, the power plant has hired students to work there. The tribal council has hired students. We have people working at the weather service, KSKO as media people. And so they're getting a lot of good experiences that way, too. And they also provide dollars on occasion. So the partnerships work really well. Last slide. So that's our commitment, is to meet each student's needs and each staff member's professional goals, whatever it takes. We're there to try it.
Karen, thank you. I believe we have a couple of questions here. Representative Pruitt?
This one shouldn't be too difficult. I want to highlight the innovation of your students out there. I saw on one of your slides where they have the face-to-face events, you mentioned that your students help raise the money for their travel. What ways do they raise the money for their travel? What innovative methods are they using out there?
They have raffles. They're probably the age-old, time-tested methods. Food. They cook dinners and they deliver them to people's homes. And parents are helping out. And they do a lot of raffles. The kids, you know, they're pretty crafty. They make a lot of nice beadwork, carvings, and things that they raffle off. And again, parents help in those events. But mostly food-related, I would say. They raise the most dollars that way.
Well, good. I think they're to be commended after looking at the cost to just have a charter. Obviously, they've got a lot of work that they have to do. So I don't know about the rest of the committee, but they're to be commended on the effort that they're putting into it.
Last year, the village of Anvik, the community raised $40,000 to send their students, their whole school, to Hawaii after school was out.
Wow. That's great.
And a lot of parents went on that trip, too. But anyway, yeah. Kids are pretty driven to help.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of my questions is that you're so isolated, and for teachers that can, and it sounds like you're doing wonderful things to at least help them feel like they're not isolated, but what is your teacher turnover rate?
Last year was really high. It was 50%. The year before that, it was a real, we had a couple of years where teachers stuck around for about 3 years, but last year was the highest I've seen in a long time, 50%. We're hoping we don't have that kind of turnover this year.
Another
follow-up?
Sounds like you've been there for a while, even though this is your first year as superintendent. How long have you been with the school district?
Actually, I moved out here in 1979 to teach, and but I have only worked for the district for 15 years. I took a lot of different time off, worked for the university for 5 years, actually left the community of McGrath for a couple of years. So I only have 15 years in with the school district, but I do have my home here, and I did raise my family here. My children are all raised here.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Faye?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, Mr. Lattergaard, in reference to the question earlier about the rules regarding the tests, what other rules that or regulations that are imposed by the state could be changed that just a simple rules change would enable you to save considerable amounts of money? Without sacrificing the educational program.
Okay, I've got Isabel here, and she's got an idea.
Well, another expense that costs us quite a bit each year is the inspections by the fire marshal, and I don't know if that could be changed anyway, but that's another huge expense and that we end up bearing. And again, that's a charter going around from site to site to site.
Excuse me, Isabel, so you're saying that the big expense is flying the fire marshal around, or are there additional expenses?
Flying the fire marshal around.
Okay. Any other questions from committee? Representative Wilson?
I'd like a little more detail, Isabel. Like, you have to I assume you have to fly them from Fairbanks. And how much does that cost to get him from Fairbanks and then to fly all around to all the schools? Do you have an idea there that you could let us know?
Well, just our hub actually is Anchorage and on Fairbanks, so a flight from Anchorage to McGrath, for example, this is where they usually start, is about a little over $400. And then it's a charter to Nicolai and to Continent, about 381 round trip to Nicolai, about 250 to Continent. And then, as Karen mentioned in her presentation, flights from McGrath to the other side of our district charter is about 1,200, and then you go through the villages over there. So all in all, in a day or two, it amounts to about $10,000 just for that travel.
Okay. Would it be easier just to buy and fly in a new? When he comes in, I suppose he checks a lot of other things, but he also doesn't he check the fire extinguishers and stuff?
He does that, but what we're trying to do in situations like that is get somebody trained on staff that's able to do that.
So he does stuff that. So that person does things that no one else can be trained to do.
Yeah. Yeah, his inspection, I believe, is mandatory, and it's actually for the safety of kids.
Sure. So, but that's $10,000.
One of those, you know, large cost items, one-shot large cost items, like the testing. And some of those other rules and regulations, I'm trying to think off the top of my head as well, Karen, one of the things could be changed just slightly that would help us, and I'll have to think about that a little bit, Karen.
Okay, Representative.
You know, that would be a good idea.
That's a big one right there. The fire marshal's a big one. The testing is really huge because it happens a couple of times a year.
Okay. Representative Faye, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The air taxis in town might not appreciate this, but would it make more sense economically if the school district utilized an aircraft that it owned?
Buys an aircraft. Yeah.
We actually looked into that a number of years ago, and between the liability and the hiring of a pilot and, you know, the aircraft, maintaining the aircraft hangar and all that, it would not be a cost savings to us at all. As it is, we try to we work with other agencies in the community. We have a lot of other state agencies here, and we try to work with them to coordinate travel to the different sites. So we try to split charters as much as we can. But there's a lot of things, a lot of times that we just got to get somebody out there.
Okay, thanks.
Even though we're spread out, it's just not cost effective to us. Other districts have made it cost effective. Bering Strait has had a plane for years. One thing Karen did note, and we don't have a lot of big sports programs, we are no longer in ASA because our sites are small, and the cost of flying from like here to Uniclaid or Galena to any other site, so we are unable to do those programs now.
But that's mainly due to drop enrollment. Because the kids used to, when I was a principal at McGrath School in 1994 to 1998, when we had 150 students here, we now only have 53 here in McGrath. But, at that time, you know, kids were traveling every single weekend for sports, but they were raising tons of money for that, too. But, you know, I have mixed feelings about purchasing an airplane. We would put the local air taxis out of business, and we really don't want to do that either, because they're all our partners here.
Okay. Representative Sisney, you had a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it was a question that actually would be to our system, and that is combining some of these, the very necessary oversight that and inspections, making sure that people are trained for the equipment in the community. There's numbers of those kinds of things that must be done. But oftentimes don't get done, and it's because of the cost. And I'm wondering if it's possible to schedule flights that actually involve different entities that have oversight responsibility for equipment in communities. And the fire marshal, I had a school in my district that burned down, and it was a horrifying experience. No one was hurt, but what it does to the student population is really it's devastating. So it's something that you do want to make sure doesn't happen. At the very same time, we've got to have inspections. We've got to make sure that when the state puts facilities in communities, that they're kept right up to the standard that is required for safety.
Karen, maybe I could respond to that. I know the director of maintenance, Dave Shelbourne, tried to retire, and they couldn't find anybody in the state willing to do his job. It was so difficult. And so he actually wanted to retire many years ago, and just out of dedication, he's actually stayed on. Is that a fairly accurate assessment, Karen?
Actually, he's retired.
Pity. Good for him. All right.
I have hired another maintenance director.
Wonderful.
Those are real tall shoes to fill because David's been in there for, 25, 30 years and knows every nut and bolt and screw in every one of our schools. And so we've had to retain him on a consultant basis to help, just provide technical assistance.
Okay, any other questions?
He did retire 5 years ago, but he came back.
He tried to retire 5 years ago, and then it took another 5 years to get somebody to finally.
Maintenance is huge because our schools are so small, kind of made of scale. It's just really hard to hire. I mean, how many hours a day can we hire a maintenance person in Nicolai for, where they only have 15 kids? So we have a 2 or 3 hour a day maintenance provider on site, but for 2 or 3 hours a day, he wears several other hats in the community, and he sits on a lot of boards, and he travels. You know, it's just really hard to keep people like that around. Other sites, you know, the better job comes around that's full-time with benefits. We certainly are not going to be able to hold a person for a 2 or 3 hour a day job. So it's hard, and we do provide a lot of training. We have monthly training sessions by video conference for all of our maintenance staff as well, plus a lot of, as the maintenance director travels around, a lot of on-site training. But, however, usually when the maintenance director gets to a site, there's so many, you know, so many situations he has to deal with, leaks and you know, hooking up a new dishwasher or whatever, that the training part is just, you know, working alongside the maintenance person in each site.
Well, Karen, very good. I really appreciate you've brought a perspective that we haven't heard yet. We hope to hear from superintendents all over the state, but I think people here have a better idea where I come from. And I for years, since I got here, I've been telling people I was the best teacher in Tulida. And, of course, I was the only one when I was there. So.
Poor Alan. And Lloyd Village, too, I think, right?
Yeah, that's true. So, well, Karen and Isabel, thank you. It's been very informative. You've really helped open our eyes here. And, again, the commissioners here listen to every word, and we'll certainly stay in touch. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity. Have a good day.
Okay, that ran a little bit long, but I think it was pretty important to get that view of the state. The purpose of our meeting today is to take up the following legislation, HB 104, Alaska Performance Scholarship, sponsored by Governor Parnell, and HB 5, Constitutional History Curriculum, sponsored by Representative Wes Keller. And neither bill will leave the committee today, but we're certainly going to have a good time entertaining the conversation on them, and I understand there will also be a committee substitute for HB 104, and we'll have a discussion on that by Representative Seaton. So HB 104 will now be taken up for consideration. Let's see, would a representative of the administration come forward to present the bill? Excuse me.
Can we take a brief at ease?
Brief at ease. Education committee come to order. I think we resolved that, and that was a wonderful suggestion, but I believe we could solve the issue. I just want to acknowledge that Debbie Mackey from Galena is here with students from Close Up. If you'd mind to stand up, and we welcome you here. And
there are also students from the Kenai Peninsula School District as well, and Galena School District.
Wonderful. Good to have every one of you. Thank you for coming. Okay.
It's more effectively on the record because that depends on who you want to say it under here because they can't hear it.
Okay. Okay, for the record, we have students from the Kenai Peninsula and as well as Galena. Okay. So will a representative, HB 104, will be taken up for consideration. Eddie Jeans, I understand you're our man this morning, and would Commissioner Henley, you want to join us, or was that?
I think
Eddie's got it covered. I'm sure he does. Okay. Would you just walk us through the bill, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Education Policy Coordinator for the Department of Education, and I'm here today to walk you through House Bill 104. Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to walk through the sectional analysis because the bill as it is presented before you today is pretty short and to the point. So the first thing I'd like to point out is the first sections, 1 through 6 in the bill, simply deal with the name change of the scholarship program from the Alaska Merit Scholarship Program to the Alaska Performance Scholarship. Mm-hmm. The legislation that was passed last year with the name Alaska Merit Scholarship had some trademark issues that apparently we were infringing on. So that's why we had to take a look at changing the name of the program. Section 7, Mr. Chairman, establishes the Alaska Performance Scholarship Award Fund. This is the fund that the money would be deposited into, in which awards would be paid out of. Once the appropriations are made to the fund, the Alaska Post-Secondary Commission would then be able to pay awards out of that fund without further appropriation. Any unspent balance in that fund would remain in that fund for future awardees. So if we make an appropriation of $8 million, we only need $7 million. At the end of the year, there would be $1 million left over for the subsequent year. Mr. Chairman, Section 8, once again, is simply a name change. And then Section 9 starts to get into the meat of the bill. This is where the fund would be established that would generate income that would then be transferred into the award account or award fund to pay for the awards. Governor Parnell has recommended that $400 million be allocated for this purpose. We are anticipating about a 5% annual return on that fund, and that income from that fund is what the legislature would then appropriate to the awards account. Section 9 deals with the Commissioner of Department of Revenue and how he's to invest those funds and report back to the legislature. Section 9 deals with the Commissioner of Revenue and reporting to the legislature the amount of funds that are available for appropriation. Skipping down to Section 10, we start to get into the tax credits. Section 10 through 11 deal with tax credits for those corporations that make donations to the Alaska Scholarship Investment Account. And if you want to get into details about that, I am not the expert, but we do have one in the audience today, Joanna Biles from Department of Revenue. Section 12 simply deletes some references to programs that no longer exist in the Alaska Post-Secondary Commission. Section 13 is transition language. And then Section 14 instructs the statute reviser to make the name changes and make it consistent throughout the laws. Section 15 is the transition language that allows the departments to develop regulations to implement the new law. Section 16 allows us to start to develop and adopt those regulations immediately, so we can get a little jump start on that. And then Section 17 deals with the remaining component of the effective dates, and Section 18 has the effective dates for Section 16 and 17. And Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have on this piece of legislation at this time.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sisna.
Thank you, and I wish I could say I had read this completely. I have not. And I'm wondering if there is in this legislation the ability to contribute to this fund through the permanent fund dividend process.
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, I do not believe that contributions through the permanent fund dividend are available in this piece of legislation.
A follow-up, please.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Would it be possible to add it, or would it somehow make this piece of legislation not work?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, I don't think that it is impossible to add that component. The tax credit was intended for probably larger donations than what you would see through donations made through the permanent fund dividend.
Follow up?
I think I would really appreciate being one of those people that made maybe a small contribution, but nonetheless, small grows large when people get into things.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Eddie, are you talking about version A or version I?
Through the chair, we're working off of version A. That's the bill that was submitted by the Rules Committee on behalf of the governor.
Okay. That's correct. Any other questions from committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
Thanks. Just a clarification on Representative Sisson's question on page 5, line 15. It says the fund consists of appropriations to the fund or donations to the fund. Although the tax credits are a mechanism, they're not a, are they a restrictive mechanism so that the only donations of the fund are those tax credits?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, they are not restrictive. And you're correct. There, individuals could make donations to the fund. What I was referring to, Representative Sisna, is it's not currently part of our recommendation to go on to the check it donation mechanism in the permanent fund system.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On section 11, and I realize this particular bill does not specifically deal with the tax credit amounts, but you have it, you mentioned that the tax credit will be up to $5 million and it has a sunset date of January 1st, 2014. Why is that, seems to me that's kind of a short limit on companies' abilities to deduct that amount of money from their taxes. Why does it sunset, I guess, is the question.
Through the chair, Representative Feige, the governor's bill did not address the sunset clause that you're referring to. It simply added the performance scholarship as a recipient or a participant in the tax credit. I believe in the committee substitute that you'll be receiving, there is a the sunset issue is addressed and extended.
Extended till?
I think it was 2021.
Okay.
And Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, two questions here. How does this particular fund affect the UA Scholars Award?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it does not affect the UA Scholars. The UA Scholars is a program that's administered by the University of Alaska and is a totally separate, independent program.
Could, and at times, would there be overlapping?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, there absolutely could be overlapping. The UA Scholars program is for the top 10% of the students that perform in individual schools. So you could run into a situation where a student qualifies for a UA Scholars as well as a merit scholarship or a performance scholarship award.
And then secondly, I also saw on here the on section 4, there's the under A1, 2, and 3, there's, we talk about the requirements, and I think we, this had been discussed the last time we had a presentation, that the requirements for the various levels, we talk about the grade point average, and what I'm curious about is when it when we refer to the score on the college entrance examinations, there's the wording is either very high minimum, or moderately high minimum. Does that leave room for interpretation, or is that I know in the when we had our presentation there were specific numbers that were given.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, those designations allow the department through regulation to set the cut scores at different levels for the different award levels. And you're correct, in the presentation that we did before, the cut scores were 25, 23, and 21 for the ACT. So if you scored a 25 or better, you were eligible for the highest award level, but you also have to have at a minimum a 3.5 GPA or higher to qualify for that level. And so those references to very high, high, moderately high, just allow us through the regulatory process to establish those cuts.
Okay, thank you.
I personally have a question, and we just heard from Iditarod School District, and I think it's a wonderful idea, you know, giving young people an incentive to do well in school. But as we heard Superintendent Lattergaard say, like we're talking about a core curriculum, 4 years of mathematics, language arts, science, et cetera, do you see any problems with trying to implement this and make it equitable for students to come from rural communities as compared to those in larger ones?
Representative Dick, we know we're going to have some difficulties there, and we have been working with school districts to assist them in meeting the requirements of the scholarship program, as well as we have a transition period before it's fully implemented, about 3 years. So as I mentioned in a previous presentation, we also have issued a contract with Southeast Regional Resource Center to develop the virtual school for a statewide basis. We have 12 school districts that are participating in that. Some are rural school districts and some are urban districts. So we have a nice blend there of districts that are recognizing that they are deficient in some areas, and they're looking for creative ways to meet the requirements of the program. And as you heard from Superintendent Lendengard, that, you know, the district is using video conferencing themselves to deliver some of the secondary courses. So we applaud them for doing that, and we know we have a long ways to go.
Representative Kawasaki.
On that point, Eddie, the schools that are participating in the whatever digital learning thing, is that at a cost to that district, or is the Department of Education paying for it right now?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the districts that are participating in it are actually assisting in developing and making the curriculum available through this consortium. So it's my understanding there is no cost to those districts that are part of the consortium. Those that want to access those services, there will be a cost for the individual courses. But I don't know what the costs are at this point.
Just to follow up, so in the future, I guess Department of Education would likely administer some sort of a program for rural districts, especially that don't have access to maybe 4 years of science. Is that kind of the idea?
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, the virtual school is just one of many mechanisms that would assist rural districts that don't have the capability to offer those higher level mathematic courses or science courses. There are other statewide correspondence programs that are currently operating that they could contract with. Just like this presentation here, we know in Northwest Arctic School District, they have video conferencing in all of their sites. Kotzebue is a large community, and they do have the highly qualified teachers in that community, so they would be on one end of the video conferencing, providing the instruction, and the teacher assisting on the other end.
Sure. I guess the point, Mr. Chairman, that I wanted to make was it would be at the expense of the school district. It would be an added expense for the school district possibly.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we provide all the school district's foundation funding to, you know, provide the instructional programs that their children need. If they have to contract with somebody else, I guess you could say that would be an added expense. But we do provide state foundation funding to support the instructional programs.
Any other questions? Thank you, Eddie. That was good. I understand that Carl Rose would like to testify regarding this bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Good morning.
I believe this is my first time testifying before this committee this year. I'm Carl Rose, the Executive Director of the Association of Alaska School Boards. We have 53 school districts in the state, and the association represents all of their interests. I would share with you the mission of the Association of Alaska School Boards is to advocate for children and youth, assist local school boards in providing a quality education focused on student achievement through effective local governance. The reason that we're here today is this is a tremendous opportunity for Alaska to have a scholarship program, and we support that idea. Our concerns have already been raised, and the issue is one of universal access for all students. We can say that this exists across our state, but in fact, there's no other state in the union that faces the geographic expanse, the cultural diversity of the remote Arctic challenges that Alaska faces, digital technology for learning is the only viable option that we have to close this gap of difference between us as Alaskans and the world around us. So I would ask you to consider the scholarship is a good idea. It's in place and it's moving forward. I don't know that our school districts are prepared digitally to take full advantage of this opportunity. So my concern would be, and our challenge as a state is, universal access for all kids so that all kids can benefit from this incentive. This is an incentive. How do we ensure that all kids can take advantage of it? The Alaska Performance Scholarship is but one reason why we should be taking a look at increasing the technology, digital technology, and footprint of technology across our state. There are a number of issues that we have moving forward, and I guess I'll just keep this to the scholarship for right now. We have the ability to incrementally grow this footprint right now through the, and I will talk about this at some other time, through the consortium of digital learning that has existed since 2006 and was funded 2006 and 2008. The ability for us to do this on an incremental basis, we don't have the capacity to address the entire state at this time. But every time we make capital appropriations for school districts in the area of technology, what assurances do we have that those appropriations will be successfully implemented, and what kind of accountability do you have in terms of feedback that has been done and the challenges have been met? I have more information on this. I'll share with you later, but there is an option to take full advantage of a scholarship like this. As it sits right now, some of the brightest and the best who have access to the courses and instruction will benefit from this. And there are a whole bunch of people in Alaska who could take advantage of this if we had the wherewithal to do it. So I suggest to you that we pay attention to our entire state and start now, because it will take some time to create a system that can respond to this incentive. So I will hold my comments there. We generally support the scholarship. We think it's a great opportunity for kids. We advocate for children and youth. We think it's a great idea, but if this is for all kids, then we have to make it universally accessible. So thank you for your time, and I'll try to answer any questions you might have.
Any questions from committee? Representative Sisna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I know that you have done for these many years is really looking at technology and coming up with different ideas of how to expand technology throughout our school systems. What do you see as kind of the connectivity and where the greatest parts are? Do we have in our secondary elementary, maybe not as important, but do we have improved technology, and where do you see the real strengths in that maybe could actually be built on some way to really make what you're saying happen?
Thank you, Representative Sisna. Through the chair, I think there are about five questions in there, but I'll try to move through this. The issue of bandwidth is an issue everywhere you go. Let's not you know, halt in our tracks because of bandwidth. The existing bandwidth allows us to do some things. We should take full advantage of it, and we should advance our ability to deal with technology based on the limitations as we see them today. Bandwidth is like supply and demand. The more demand we have, you know, the more bandwidth will be available because it's costly. So it's an easy axiom to figure out. The issue of technology in our schools, and I would say the focus on technology is maybe more important at the elementary grades.
Okay.
Because when we deal with young people today, this is the way they communicate. This is their medium. This is their pencil and paper. You know what I'm talking about, Representative Dick. Pencil and paper is the way we learn. That's not the way they learn today. So we have the ability to provide an opportunity for kids to use a medium that they're very accustomed to advance their, not only their learning, but their awareness of the world around them. The issues that we face of relevance and a realistic view of the world around them as it's happening is critically important, because if it's not as it is happening, it's already history. Things that are happening today, by the time they wind up in a textbook, they're history. So when you talk about where we're going into the future, we are at the precipice of exponential change. What are we doing as a state to ensure that our citizens are well prepared for a future that we cannot describe to them right now? This is a huge challenge, but it's not insurmountable. We're in 100 schools right now. We have 28 school districts that are on board. We are expending the last of us $7.5 million effort. I'm getting way off the scholarships, and I appreciate the latitude, but I want to draw back to say that if our kids are going to be ready to take advantage of this incentive, there are vehicles available to us now. You've heard about video conferencing. There are a lot of tools that we have, but we need to ensure that our kids have the ability to access the information that would enhance their ability to take advantage of this. I think I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Sort of on a similar point, I mentioned, or I asked a question to Eddie Jeans, Department of Education. If we do this digital classroom, and he said it was just one of the ways, I guess there's still inequity in school districts that would probably not be able to participate. Can you sort of elaborate on some of those problems? And then the question of funding, how we get those school districts up to that point. Just a suggestion from you and the School Board Association.
Thank you, Representative Kawasaki. Through the chair, there are a number of ways that you can go about doing this. The way that we do it right now is we do it through appropriation, when we have done it, through the Consortium for Digital Learning. And the onus has been on a consortium to identify the areas of need, the willing participants, and to provide these wraparound services to individual districts. Where we're looking at going now is to provide the flow of appropriations directly to the recipients. Whoever are in the House or Senate districts, whatever appropriations are made, that money should go through a portal, and we think the portal is the CDL, the Consortium for Digital Learning. So in terms of how you fund this, it would be through a capital budget. That's the most direct appropriation. In terms of how we do it, I imagine for a school district, it would be a zero fiscal note, because we're used to those. We receive a foundation, as Mr. Jeans have pointed out, and that money is used to provide for the maintenance and operation of our schools. Many times, we are mandated by legislation, and there's a fiscal note of zero because we have a foundation formula. I would share with all of you, and I think you understand, the weight gets a little heavy when you continue to mandate with zero fiscal notes on one foundation formula. So that's a number of issues that you talk about. Issues of equity, we try to address those through the foundation formula with cost differentials and the like. But when it comes to technology, the remoteness of some of our villages are more of a challenge. Satellites, microwaves, the available bandwidth, the ability to manage the time that you use the system so that you don't collapse, the ability to review the condition of readiness so that when you put technology in, you can actually get the system up and running and functioning. These are all challenges that we face, But if we don't focus on these challenges and prepare our kids for this uncertain future, they may not have the opportunity to take advantage of a scholarship such as this. That was the original point of my testimony, so I kind of draw us back. We support the concept. Our challenge is now universal access. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
Just to follow up on the equality of academic opportunity and academic access to this, particularly this piece of legislation, do you see a legal issue setting itself up there if we're not, if we offer this program, but school districts that just cannot fund anything new might have a disparity when it comes to that, when it comes to access to this scholarship?
Representative Kawasaki, through the chair, my reference point for this was I got my law degree from the University of Klakwan. So, yes. I would share with you that equity is always an issue, and it's in the eye of the beholder. And you know, we can always make a case for equity. The issue has to be, does that compel us to move forward, or doing the right thing compel us to move forward? I would suggest that as a state, we want to do the right thing by our kids and move forward and advance this issue. The courts don't necessarily answer any questions when we go there for equity. But I think if we do this as a state for all the right reasons, we're far better off. Thank you.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Carl, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with the idea of technology solving all our problems. I mean, I've had close-up students come in and talk with me, some of them sitting in the back of the room, that have said that sitting in front of the computer for 6 hours a day answering questions, I mean, it's just like a workbook if you use it that way. So is the bandwidth the problem, or is the way we use the medium to make sure that it engages students and involves them in ways which will promote learning the more challenging aspect of technology? I mean, if we have, I mean, we can send out hard drives into the community with terabytes of data, but if it's basically a workbook that's, or a book that's on a computer screen, that hasn't changed the engagement of the student, whether he's working on a pencil and paper or whether he's working on a computer screen. So I'm concerned if we're saying that the equity is going to be just bandwidth and not the actual delivery, the engagement and delivery of that product.
Thank you, Representative Seaton, through the chair. You bring up a great issue. One of the things that we have found in the years of operating the Consortium for Digital Learning is the condition of readiness is important, the technical assistance to ensure that these systems are up and running is important, and most important is the professional development to ensure that our teaching staff is using this technology for learning. We're not teaching technology here, we're using it for learning. If you use technology, you can use technology like a textbook, or you can use technology to access information at your fingertips. That is, it's a huge learning tool if used properly. Like so many things that we do, if you look at technology at face value and use it, as you say, to simply drill and answer questions, you could do that with textbooks. But with technology, you can connect to the world. At your fingertips, the entire Library of Congress is available to you. How many of you have recently bought an encyclopedia? Well, I haven't bought one in the last 15 years, but you don't need to anymore because it's online. You can get all that information. So I guess what I would say, Representative Seaton, the issue of equity is not bandwidth. The issue of equity is how do we use technology to assist young people in learning. Not, we don't have to teach young people how to use technology. They're teaching us.
No.
Right? But to use technology for learning, I think, is the critical issue.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Carl, you said sort of the head of the umbrella organization kind of overwatches schools throughout the state. Talking about the how to use the technology and how to use the hardware, which school districts are being the most innovative
and which particular organizations could we look to as a state to set the standard for future development along those lines?
Representative Feige, through the chair, excellent question. We have pockets of success all around our state. We have individuals who are extremely talented, and they all provide through a consortium to help us build this footprint. I would say right now, the Association of Alaska School Boards may be the entity that is involved with the Consortium for Digital Learning, but it is a consortium. We have plans to work more closely with the Alaska Society of Technology and Education. These are people from all the school districts who deal in technology, the technology directors. They're a tremendous resource. Somebody needs to help them to get their abilities connected to where the need is. Individual school districts, we have success in individual school districts. I could get a list to you on what we have done. And if you gauge by comparison of where we started to where we are, we have come a long way. We have seen the relevance of technology, and we are not going back. I would say in this building here, you can't do it without technology anymore. We can't go back. So everything is moving forward. We have a number of success stories, and the question has to be, in consortia, how many groups of people can we get together to assist in what the state needs to do? I would share with you the executive director of the Alaska Council of School Administrators, Dr. Bruce Johnson, worked with the School Board Association as our director for the Consortium for Digital Learning for, I can't remember, eight to 10 years. He was fundamental in the creation of this effort, and we hope to embody what we're doing now across the spectrum. More and more people are becoming dependent on technology, and the question has to be, it's not just a tool anymore. How do we use it to advance what we need to do for our young people? So I would just share with you, there's not one point that I can give you that says this is how to do it. We have so much diversity in the state in terms of need and talent that suggests our success. And if we work together in consortia and take an opportunity to build on these, it really helps us. So I think I'll stop there, but thank you for your question.
A follow-up, Representative Feige?
In acknowledging Representative Seaton's question as well, you know, technology isn't necessarily the be-all or the end-all. Just on a personal note, where did you go to high school?
I went to high school in Hawaii, Kaimuki High School in Hawaii.
Okay.
Representative Sisna?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Fascinating discussion, extraordinarily important, but what I've seen is that there's some real serious holes, and one of them happens to be right here, because I've been in small remote communities and been online with a number of communities all right there looking at me and looking at each other and doing some of the social networking that's absolutely critical to deal with some of the big problems we have, which nobody focuses on. Has to do with domestic violence, breakdown in communities, all of that stuff. Digital can play a big part, but not if they're not connected to the people who make the big decisions. And in this room, I guess you can not Skype, but you can do something here. If you've got a camera here, that helps. That puts things out. But we could have everybody talking to us and be here, and without decision makers being in on this, having the administrative people in on this, we stand still the way we are right now, and it's scary. That's all I can say.
Representative Pruitt.
Thank you so much for talking about technology. That's one of the things I have said that I think is key, especially in a place like Alaska. Is the consortium have a specific type of technology they think is kind of higher level? For instance, is broadband the number one thing? Do they feel that it's new computers, computers for every kid. I mean, what specific thing do they think is probably the highest on the list there when it comes to the technology?
Representative Pruitt, through the chair, in 1986 when we started, we thought that a one-to-one relationship with one computer for every child, and it was a laptop, that was the thing to do. Here we are 5 years later, and we have mobile devices. We got iPhones. We've got pads. We've got so much technology available to us. If you stop to think about it, anything that you purchase top of the line right now is already obsolete because R&D is developing the next wave. So the question is not waiting to the silver bullet till you get the best piece. It's dealing with technology now and growing as the need grows and as new innovation comes along. I would share with you that technology, not in its form of laptops, rollouts, mobile devices, all of those are part of a solution. The question has to be, what is the solution on site? What is it that we need on site? And those decisions should be made. If you want to use whiteboards, whatever you want to use, those are the things that we should be focusing on, and the plan to infuse technology into the curriculum so that we're using it for learning. That's what is driving us. So we don't have any specific issue that we point to and say, this is how to do it. I think each individual school district needs to decide what is best for them, and we support that.
Okay. I think we're going to... This is a very important bill and a huge issue. I think we're going to move on here.
I think it's a good idea, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman.
Yeah. You've been in the hot seat long enough. But I do appreciate you, Carl. You have such insight, so we're all learning from you. Thank you, sir. My record shows that we have Johanna Bales here, who is from the Department of Revenue, who could answer questions if we have any regarding funding. Are there any questions from the committee? Okay. There will be further chances to testify about the bill. So, Representative Seaton has prepared a blank committee substitute that incorporates the suggestions of the Scholarship Task Force. And so I would ask, do we have a motion for the committee substitute, House Bill 104, Version 1, for the purpose of discussion?
So moved.
Version I. I believe.
Oh, excuse me. Version I. Excuse me.
Yeah, so moved.
Thank you. If there's no objections, so ordered. Representative Seaton, would you explain the differences between what the committee substitute and the original?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And we had a presentation earlier, the previous meeting, on the legislative funding task force that was set up. The education committees in the House and the Senate both adopted provisions of this bill, of the scholarship bill, that at the end of last session went forward and were streamlined to get something in place, and then a legislative task force was set up. And so version I incorporates the recommendations that were from both in the House and Senate committees last year and were the result of the discussions and the recommendations of the legislative funding scholarship funding task force. So first of all, in version I, what I'd like to do is go through the provisions in there instead of going through line by line, and then we can go through line by line if you desire, if that's acceptable. So the first thing this does is it adds a need-based component to the merit scholarship. In other words, someone has to qualify for the merit scholarship, and then if there is unmet need, what it does is it delineates that 50% of the unmet need as determined under the FAFSA, that's after family contribution, after all Pell grants, after all other grant sources of funding, and less $2,000, which was set up as a requirement for student himself or herself participating through work, that amount would be that needs-based component. The second thing the CS does is adds the Alaska Advantage program into this funding stream, so that the Alaska Advantage
program, as you recall from previous presentations, was for non-traditional students. So we have the three parts. We have the merit scholarship or performance scholarship fund portion. We have the needs-based component to allow those that get the merit scholarship and financially aren't going to be able to use it because there's unmet need and they have no resources or no way to get loans or anything else for that because they don't have assets to back that up. And then the third one is the Alaska Advantage. All three of those would be under one funding source, which is this Alaska Scholarship Fund. And the bill further takes and replaces, actually repeals the title of the Capital Income Fund, which is in the general fund now, and replaces that with the Scholarship Fund. And it also transfers the assets that are currently in the Capital Income Fund to the Scholarship Fund, which is about $70 million. And just to remember that the next thing it does, it directs the revenue stream that currently goes to the Capital Income Fund to the Scholarship Fund. Now, that revenue fund, that revenue source is the Amaretta Hess settlement, oil settlement money that's in the permanent fund, which can't be used for permanent fund dividends. And that revenue stream, the income from that, would then be directed to the scholarship fund. That those numbers were generally in $22 to $30 million a year. We've had a couple of years where we had a real downturn, so it was zero. So there was very little money come, but normally it's in that range of $22 to $30 million. And then the next thing it does, it identifies up to 15% of the oil tax progressivity with a maximum amount, combined amount with the Amaretta Hess money of $40 million could be directed to the scholarship fund. And then it also allows direct appropriations and the other provisions of the governor bill, donations, those tax credits, those can go in as well. The other thing it does, it sets a $160 million cap on the fund. And this, if the legislature decides to remove the funding streams from the bill, it would retain enough money in it to wind down and fund the people that we've made contractual commitments with that have gotten the scholarships, because there's eight semesters for those that are going to the universities, or four semesters, 2 years if they're going to a vocational technical, but that would allow that to wind down and fulfill those commitments if a future legislature would decide to do that without having to appropriate more money for that if someone had made that determination. This also adds the requirements that were recommended by the Scholarship Funding Task Force that receiving institutions make sure these are valuably spent, these monies that the state is coming forward with, by first of all requiring that they have an advisor advocate program so that we make sure that we keep have a way to keep these students on track so that they will be able to progress through the system. One of the worst things that we thought in the task force was that if we're investing this money and letting people, you know, go a semester and just lose track and then they drop out, well, that's really not a good use of the state funds, because what we're trying to do is get students through to completion of certificates or completion of degrees. And then it puts some transition language in there that ramps up the amount so that it's $20 million in the first year and $30 million in second, and then up to $40 million in the subsequent years, because we won't have a full complement of 4 years of students coming forward through the program. So that transition language is in there. And then it puts the effective dates in for the completion of regulations so that we're not putting the agencies in a position where we're requiring them to do something before they have enough time to promulgate the regulations to implement the program.
So, Mr. Chairman, that is the portions of this document that are different than the governor's bill. It's a different funding mechanism, and there wasn't legislative will in the last legislature to adopt a $400 million an account to put $400 million in to do this. The legislative task force found that there was not significant impetus among the legislature to do that, and also when we rolled in the needs-based components and all, the $400 million account would not satisfy the needs of the scholarship fund as well. So basically that's the I'd be happy to answer any questions, and for details, my staffer who's worked on this, Katie Kester, is available, so she could walk us through you know, very the details if you wish.
Very good. Katie, do you want to come forward?
Okay. For the record, Katie Kester, staff to Representative Seaton. Chairman Dick, how would you like me to proceed with more of a section-by-section comparison, or would you like the committee to have an opportunity to ask questions?
Let's ask questions first. Okay. Any questions? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As we set up this, or as we attempt to set up this fund, is there any provision in the legislation that requires that money that we as the people of the state of Alaska spend on these students, it's obviously to educate them, but is there any condition attached to that funding that requires them to come back and work within the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Feige, not that I know of.
Mr. Chairman, if we're talking policy questions, I could probably answer those better if
is it in the bill? I don't see it in the bill.
And Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Representative.
The requirement is that you attend an institution in Alaska. So we are taking our dollars and they can't go outside, so it wouldn't be a return. You have to physically be here and take the classes here in Alaska at either an accredited university, post-secondary institution, or a program that is certified by the Department of Labor as an adequate preparation for a certificate in a vocational arena.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I think we've found on the committee before that research shows that if kids go to school in Alaska, they stay in Alaska, but if they go to school outside, they stay outside. I mean, overall, that's, of course, some of them do one or the other, but.
Representative Feige.
It seems to me as a way to guard against the risk, if you will, of a student going to university in Alaska and accepting the state's money, that it's a reasonable request on our part for that student to remain in Alaska and to put that into the conditions of the bill. I got a full scholarship to college, and I had very stringent conditions upon, you know, if I did not fulfill the agreement to serve 5 years in the military, that you know, I had to pay that money back. We don't seem to have any provisions in this bill that accomplishes that, and I think that is a fair and reasonable request for the state to make based on the conditions that we're providing these kids based on their performance, which is great, but we should also make sure our investment is recovered in some way.
Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, I just point out that was a full ride scholarship. This scholarship is for tuition, the merit portion, and although we could do that, I think that we are probably it would be difficult to say that every student that goes to the university has to remain in Alaska, otherwise their scholarship is converted to a loan or something else. I think that just That's just discussion, Mr. Chairman. We can have that.
Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to kind of add to the discussion, I know back in the 80s when some students would take out student loans through the state and they would leave this, they would leave. If they came back and spent a certain amount of time within the state, they would actually get some of those loans either forgiven or in some cases all of their loans forgiven based on coming back a certain amount of time into the state. So it was a way to encourage, in that case, our best and brightest to come back after they went to school outside. So just for purposes of discussion.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
And this was quite a bit of discussion as to whether we should provide the scholarship to students that graduated in Alaska and let them go outside to school and then have a return provision. The decision, at least that time, was made that what we wanted to do was make sure they stayed in Alaska, that they attended Alaska institutions, whether those institutions were the university, a private accredited college, or a certificated program, but here within the state, instead of having them go outside, and then either if they stayed outside, you have, it's a real hard nexus to go. We found this out when we had that program before. We had a lot of people, how do you catch up with them? They don't have a permanent fund dividend if they don't come back to the state. So how do you go try to catch up with a student that you've provided a scholarship to, a grant? Now you could do some kind of a loan program, but if you do a scholarship program, it's pretty hard to come back and say, okay, now we're going to retrieve the scholarship from you based on your work.
Mm-hmm. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, it seems to me that we could structure this as a loan where there are no payments due back to the state of Alaska, save for a period of 8 years after the loan would be granted. That would allow time for the student to go to college, to perhaps get an entry-level job somewhere else, and then at some point after graduation, they would still have the ability to leave Alaska and come back. Or they would have the ability to immediately come back to Alaska and set up some kind of mechanism so that for every month or every year that they're working and they can show a pay stub or some kind of proof that they're working in Alaska, that those payments are forgiven, which makes the loan essentially a grant, a scholarship grant. I think the state needs to make sure that there is some mechanism to, you know, ensure that our money is spent towards the purposes that we intend. It's one thing to educate our students, but it's also the responsibility of the student that if it takes funding from the state to be able to deliver on what the state is trying to intend with that money.
Okay. Thank you. This is good discussion. I said at the beginning, we're going to, this is not going to get out of committee today, and then nobody expected it to. So I think we've heard quite, we heard the bill, and we heard the CS. My inkling right now would be to take a brief at Representative Sisna.
Yeah, I'm back here in this corner. What I'm hearing at this table is a discussion that's a really broad discussion. And as I understand it, we are either last or close to the last in the states that achieve graduating students from high school and college. Am I correct? And if, in fact, that is true, having been a student until I was a senior in college in Washington State, there were numbers of programs. And especially as time has gone on, they've added more and more because of the importance of education, that it is critical to a state to be able to really survive itself. And we've had two discussions about two different programs, one a scholarship, one a loan, and they're both very good ideas. And I'd really be I'd be willing to do a lot of work on a loan program because I think loan programs have some advantages that scholarships don't. But we got to have some scholarships and some needs-based scholarships because we don't have any, which is really horrifying.
Thank you. What I'd like to do is I'd like to take a brief at ease. I'd like to hear HB 5, and we're definitely going to get back to this again. But I think it's going to give us a chance to amongst ourselves and just a chance to think through all of this. So if nobody minds, I'm going to call a brief at ease.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee, not just for hearing the bill, but for the work that you do. It's complex. It's a lot to it, and today's been a good illustration of that. What I'd like to do, if I could today, with the indulgence of the committee, is make some comments, and then I'd like to try to express my intent for the legislation as clearly as I can, and then I'd like to turn it over to my staff to go through section by section on the bill, and you know, so that we make sure that the intent and my comments align with the language of the bill, which is the work of the committee. So,
my neglect. Would you introduce yourself for the record?
You think I'd remember that too? I'm Representative Wes Keller, District 14. And thank you, Mr. Chair. So, if that's all right with you. Okay. There's something that I want to start out with. We have a tendency as human beings to take for granted things that are really valuable to us, and you know, maybe our spouse, maybe our family, maybe the things we have, and I think what I'm trying to address is one of those things today. It's something that we have that is a very, very high value, and something that we tend to take for granted. Before I start, I want to try to define American constitutionalism in the sense that I use it. It's a marvelous set of ideals, ideas, principles, institutions that have been created and formed as a result that has made the most prosperous nation on earth, as I'm sure you would agree. To borrow the words of an author that I came across after I started this work on the bill, George Bilius, he says American constitutionalism represents this country's greatest gift to human freedom. And that is exactly captures it very well. American constitutionalism becomes a demonstration and a standard. It has become for the whole world. We many countries that have been formed since America have used our constitution and the related documents as a standard. And also, it's more than that. It's a way we evaluate things that are going on in the world. I'm thinking about Egypt that you're reading about in a paper now. You know, you look at it, they use the right terms. You know, they've got three branches of government, the parliament, which is made up of the House, the Senate, and the judicial, and the president. But when you look at it a little closer, they have no balance of power. And they are in a very interesting dilemma. American constitutionalism, as I have used it in the bill, is what is evident in the ideals and principles that have become evident in looking at six founding documents that were formed in this country over a period from 1776 to 1791, and they include the Declaration of Independence, the Articles of Confederation, the early state constitutions, the U.S. Constitution, of course, and the Federalist, and the Bill of Rights. Each one is rich, deep, you know, lots to it and everything. And it's easy to get lost in them. And I'm not going to go into any detail and tell you things I hope that you already know. I just want to say a few things. American constitutionalism was not developed in a vacuum. It was in the context of world history and a progression of understanding of what human government is. And it's a perfect portal into the understanding and study of history and the nature of mankind. And that's why I'm proposing it as something that is important enough to hold up for our schools. American constitutionalism must be examined in a context of what was going on. Some have called it Western constitutionalism, the idea of Great Britain and France, and you know, that was being formed, the reforms in Great Britain having to do with human rights, and of course the Revolution, Reformation in France. It was all part of a group there. And It's interesting, again, going back to Egypt, the terminology that came to play there is a product of the fact that they once were a colony of Great Britain, and they had kings. Look at the history. It goes back to the pharaohs, you know, way back. And yet when we talk about and think about Egypt and what's going on there today, we use terms that are evident in our discussion of American constitutionalism. Briefly, I went online in the wonderful world that we have here and looked at the International Quran Center to see what they had to say, what was going on in Egypt. I just want to read a quote because it really illustrates the significance, I think, of the ideas, principles tied to our constitutionalism. Briefly stated, what is needed is not to amend one or two articles of the Egyptian Constitution, but to change the entire Constitution to become a true democratic one that benefits Egypt and all of Egypt's people. And that, in a sense, it's kind of unsettling because of the things that are missing from the ideals that are missing, obviously missing, in that government as it stands over there. Just for briefly, the Declaration of Independence, probably the single most important public paper that's ever printed in the United States of America. One page, signed by 56 people. It remains the most eloquent expression of the core values of American constitutionalism. And with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, I want to just read a little bit of it, just to try to catch again the excitement and the of the principles that were caught. The Declaration was called a near constitutional paper. What they mean by that is that it really isn't a constitution, but it's very much influenced the forming of our constitution. The principles therein, you know, are precious to all of us. And I'm not telling you what you don't know. But just here's an example. The phrase, the unanimous declaration of the 13 United States of America. Now, this is 13 colonies. They hadn't formed. It's just the suggestion of the federalism issues that had to be addressed as we approached the Constitution. It was evident in the Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. We've all heard that, right? And probably one of the most famous parts, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights. Among them are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That was profound. That was radical, because up until American constitutionalism came on the scene, human rights were based on what government or monarch gave a person. You know, that was the way it worked. So now all of a sudden, we come along and we introduce this principle that you have rights that are there and yours because you are human. You're a human being. Therefore, you have, you're created equal with all other people in the sense of who is to rule and who is to be ruled. So along comes American constitutionalism. As we all know, the concept of government by consent of the governed, you know, because of the equality with which we approach the whole issue of human government. Oh, Jefferson said it, I think it was on his deathbed, he said, assume, it's time for all men here, looking forward, for all men to assume the blessing and the benefits of self-government. He perceived that the Declaration of Independence, is in the same letter, was a paper that was addressed to the whole world, not just the United States of America, because there was something very unique happening in America, and that's why, they did it, that's why they pushed it forward. That's why we have such a great country. That's why we each have our individual rights. I pull you through this partly just to put it on the record and try to get our focus a little bit on the importance of going back to these papers. I've never enjoyed anything, I don't think, quite as much as the preparation time that I have had going in and getting ready for this bill. Again, Egypt. I want to go back to that one more time. They're in a ridiculous predicament over there. If Mubarak steps down or is ousted, he's the only one that can change the Constitution. And the Constitution is sewed up to take care of the people that are in control there, the National Democratic Party. You know, they can't be changed. So if he were to be eliminated, they basically are throwing out the whole Constitution, you know, and the country has to start over. Okay, here's a contrast. In America, the American constitutionalism, it came up with something really novel, a process by which the Constitution was ratified that respects the rights of the governed, you know, that to make those choices, the ratification process where the states got together and ratified it one by one. And then the amendment process that's laid out in the Constitution, where constitutional convention, but it goes back to the people. They don't have that in Egypt. So now they have this crazy catch-22 there. They got a president they don't like. People don't want him to be in power anymore, but if they take him away, they have no government. And they can't change the government because, believe it or not, it can only be done by the president. So they're in this, you know, just a horrible situation. It's something that we all watch with while we're holding our breath. Now I want to tell you what my intent is in bringing this bill forward. That was just meant to be a little bit of background. My intent is that this is a mandate on the local school districts. And that is the policy that you're going to have to deal with in the committee. I've been on the committee. I know that. I understand that. But it's not it's a mandate light, I hope. That's my intent. Okay, and my intent is that that American constitutionalism, as the concepts, the ideas, the principles that we just discussed, you know, be a something that is required as part of our education system. I say light because of the fact that the bill does not get specific as far beyond that, as far as what the content is or the approach. It has respect for the teachers, the programs that are out there. I would presume, I think it's safe presumption, that this is being taught in some of our schools. There's no question about it. It's, but I have to tell you, and I'm not here to prove to you that we need this, but we have just a couple of stories anecdotally. I have an 11-year-old boy in my district, you know, just heard of last week, that the parent was really, really concerned when she discovered that the child did not even know the three branches of government. And let me tell you something else that just blew me away. I had my staff, Jim, show me, so I saw it. That's not just an 11-year-old boy that has the problem. He's got on video, if you want to go see it, it's really interesting, the U.S. Senator from New York declaring into the camera, "We all know that we have three branches of government, the President and the House and the Senate." You know, and I just couldn't believe it. But when you see the video, you'll see he's sincere. He's believing it. I'm just saying it needs to be done. And we don't need to be real specific as far as what happens. We're just kind of putting a mandate out there, hey, do this. Teach about the founding principles of this country. I'm proud to tell you that I'm supported by my district on this. They told me that this is worth doing. And there's also a requirement for the department to come up with a resource supplement type curriculum for the district so they can grab it, presumably something they can take offline. Distance learning, I'm sure it's out there already, you know, to say, here, school districts, here's what you have to do. And it also requires the Department of Education to come up with a standard to measure whether or not kids are learning this and include it in the accountability testing like the high school qualifying exam. And so, anyway, that pretty much captures, it's something we don't want to take for granted. It's something we got that's highly, highly valuable. And I think we might be in danger of doing that if we don't do something like this to get it back on the radar screen, get it back, make sure it gets back in the schools. So with that, Mr. Chair, I would like, if I could, to ask my staff to join me up here. Mm-hmm. And Jim, he can go through the sections of the bill and describe the...
excuse me, I'm not sure how much time we have. We don't have lots of time here. Maybe we should ask for questions and comments from the committee. And I just wanted this to be, I wanted everybody to get the introduction here, so we'll have it in our minds. We'll be able to roll the thoughts around, so when we get back together again, that we'll have some chance to talk to us. I'm going to talk to myself about this and talk to the others. So I really did want to get the introduction here, but I don't want to cut you short either. No. So are there any thoughts or questions? Representative Kawasaki.
Do we have anybody else to testify or
on that sheet? Because I'll defer if there's people who wanted to speak.
On this one, huh? Brief at ease. Yes.
Mr. Chair, before you open public testimony, I wanted to say that I think we got the concept out, you know, and what Jim had to offer was more to respond to questions. And I also want to say, if I could, really briefly, I know time is limited. I know how the clock works in committee. Sometimes it zips around the 2 hours so fast you can't believe it happened, and other times every minute seems like 2 hours, you know. And when you're sitting waiting for the hot seat, I might add, it's about 2 hours, you know, per minute. But I just want to say I totally understand, and I'm very grateful for you letting me introduce the bill today. Thank you.
Are there any questions from committee? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Wes, for being here and presenting this bill. And I support the concept of this, and I took civics in high school long ago. But the question goes to the point that you mentioned that it's a mandate on school districts. We've heard from other school districts frequently that they don't have the teaching staff to teach what's necessary even for the performance scholarship, and I'd like to hear your comments on, one, whether you think that the state should start to fund it outside of maybe the BSA or something like that, and just how you what's your thoughts on the funding part of that mandate?
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Kawasaki. I guess one way to look at it is that surely they're teaching history already, and this more shapes what's happening than it does present a new mandate. You heard the testimony earlier, I think that relates, and I really sympathize. The district, when it gets these mandates, the load gets heavier and heavier, as you point to the fact that it goes on the formula money that goes out there. And I know that there's a lot of work to stretch those dollars, but then on the other hand, this is pretty core stuff. And I would assume that it's more a matter of reallocating money than coming up with new.
Follow up.
And then a follow up. You mentioned that your school board is supportive of this. And there's also a letter in here from a member from the Haynesboro School District. Do they teach civics as a course that's required in their curriculums?
I do not have the answer to that. I can find out what the requirement is.
Thanks.
I just like to comment, when I read this bill, I experienced both excitement and dread. There's many people, myself included, that really believe that the actual fate of this nation is dependent upon everybody really understanding the Constitution, because it does seem like some folks are really trying to depart from it. At the same time, the dread comes from my remembering my own civics class, and where we can't tell people how to teach, I'm really concerned that if it were taught, that it would be taught in a really enthusiastic way and an engaging way, and not the way my own seventh grade civics class is taught. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page 2 of the bill, line 18, it says, established by regulators, statewide curriculum and examination standards at all grade levels. Have you looked at the statewide curriculum standards that are there now for civics and history at all grade levels, and do those meet the requirements that you're setting out here, or are these totally separate from the current history and civics standards that are required on statewide level?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton, through the chair. Because this bill is going to come up again, I will to prepare an answer for that. That's a very good question, and we will come back with that response for the committee when we have more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
With respect for everybody's time and schedule and our need to be at our next meetings, I'm going to adjourn the meeting, but we look forward to this discussion later. I believe it's critically important for ourselves and for the nation. So thank you for your presentation. Meeting adjourned.